I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to another episode of Seriously. We've been away. Caroline, you've been on holiday in the Scottish Highlands. I think your nearest sort of pocket of civilization was Hogsmeade. Is that right?
Basically, yeah. No, I've been in the Western Isles, the Outer Hebrides, in the Isles of Lewis and Harris and North and South Uist and places like that, which was really, really great. It was really beautiful. And I went on my own and did lots of like reading and walking, and generally it was very relaxing and lovely.
Sounds like a really Lolly Willows-esque holiday.
Yeah,
without
basically.
The pact with the devil.
without any kind of particularly blatant witchcraft or anything. I did visit sort of standing stones and stuff, but I didn't do any spells. Yeah, it was really good. It was quite Harry Potter. There were a few times, actually it was when I was on the train coming back down south, that we went past a loch that I'm pretty sure is the one by Hogwarts.
Oh, how beautiful.
I didn't look this up because I didn't want it not to be.
Yeah, you can just sort of be safe in the knowledge in your heart.
Yeah, so we'll just leave it as, yes, I did go past Hogwarts. Oh. Thank you for asking.
How nice. So standing stones, but no transportation to the 18th century.
No, as we're about to talk about. I went to a place called Calanish on the Isle of Lewis, which is one of the sort of best preserved and most well-known kind of Scottish prehistoric sites. It's got three sets of standing stones. It's like, it takes about 2 hours to walk all the way around it. Really ancient, really beautiful. It's a bit like Stonehenge, like no one knows why they're there or why they're like that. There's like a circle, and then one of them, they think later they added like a cross outside each of the circles. So apparently at certain times of the year, the stones are kind of exactly lined up with certain stars and things like that. So it's all very mysterious and complicated. And I didn't really understand.
Did you feel like transported by a higher power?
Maybe, I don't know. It was still interesting and really nice. So without properly knowing what was going on. Yeah, it was good.
Cool. That sounds really nice.
And this is also, as you sort of alluded to, this is connected to the first thing we're going to talk about this week.
Yeah, which is Outlander, which is a TV show that was on Channel Stars.
What apparently. Is Channel Stars?
I have no idea. It just says Stars in the corner when you watch it.
It's on Amazon Prime. That's, I think, where most people in the world have seen it.
Yeah.
And it's an adaptation of a series of novels which are, I have subsequently found out, super famous and well-known and highly read.
Yeah, it's Diana, is it Gabaldon? Is that how you say it?
Gabaldon, I think, yeah. I'd never heard of her until I came across a TV show.
When I used to work in a bookshop, and I knew that we sold high volumes of this book or series.
And so, yeah, so this TV adaptation is based on those books, and her books are about a woman called Claire Beecham, who is on a kind of second honeymoon after the Second World War with her husband in the Highlands near Inverness, and she goes and visits a site, like I was describing, some standing stones, and something magical happens. She touches one of the stones and she gets transported back 300 years.
Something happened to me. I know it doesn't make any sense, but I seem to have fallen through time.
And she arrives in the same place geographically, but in 1743, I think it is. So it's kind of the height of Jacobite rebellion in Scotland, British people in red coats going around being awful. And she falls in with this band of Highlanders and then she has some adventures.
That's a pretty good description.
Yeah.
They sort of give her a greater knowledge of the period at hand than I think most people who were unluckily transported back in time would have. They do that by giving her modern day husband. He's a professor at Oxford and he's interested in history, and although this is not his particular period, he seems to know a lot about it. So when they're on this second honeymoon, he's pointing out different rocks and sort of old ruins and saying, oh, this was this, and you know.
And he's also helpfully, conveniently research part of the reason they're holidaying in that part of the world is because he's researching some family history that's connected to these places. So, helpfully, before she gets transported back, she's got some like nicely detailed knowledge of what was going on there.
It's one of those shows. There are a lot of things where you're like, that was lucky.
Yeah.
Which, that happens a lot. There are some things like where she's very unlucky. So, for example, in that first episode where she gets transported back, when she goes, basically she goes to look at the standing stone with her husband and they like see a ritual, like a pagan ritual happening there with lots of girls in sort of white dresses. And then she decides she wants to go back to pick up a flower. Again, you're like, really? You really want to go back by yourself just to find a flower?
She's a nurse. She was a nurse during the war. And the sort of excuse is that she saw some plant that she thinks might be some kind of, I don't know, have healing properties or something. Yeah. So she decides she wants to go back and have a look.
Yeah, so she goes back by herself, dressed in like the world's most ridiculous thin white dress. It's like clearly not summer. Well, it's like Halloween, so it's about this time, isn't it? So it's like
October,
cold.
Yeah.
How cold was it up there?
Pretty cold.
Yeah, and she goes out like in a very thin white dress, and then because it's kind of cold, she like throws some sort of rug around her shoulders and just goes out for a walk like that. And you're like, okay, this is stupid. And then she gets transported back to 1743 in that exact same outfit, except minus the rug.
Yeah.
And you're just like, this is terrible, terrible decision. Like,
and then she's kind of being chased by redcoats through the underbrush, wearing just,
I guess it works out conveniently plot-wise, because then she's not wearing like a very bizarre item of clothing. They're like, oh, you're in your slip, because it's just a plain white long dress.
I think that's probably why they did it. And the whole, I think I've watched 4 or 5 more episodes than you have, although I've not finished the series. The whole thing has that element to it. You sort of have to get over that if you're going to keep watching it, in the sense that it is sort of all quite convenient and it all does sort of line up in ways that are a bit frustrating.
Yeah, but that is part of the fun of it for me, I think, in perhaps a slightly Downton Abbey-ish way.
Oh yeah.
One of the joys of this show I found was me sat there being like, this is ridiculous, guys, come on. So the basic premise, even, which is that she like has this husband that she's quite happy with, but like, you know, there's a disconnect since the war, their relationship has not been the same, and then she gets like transported back in time and there's just like her and this hunky Highlander who like keeps conveniently getting injured when she's the only person who can nurse him back to health.
Yeah.
And I think about all the Disney films where like the moment of bonding is when the woman has to like help the action hero with like an injury, and it's like one of the laziest ways of getting two characters to come together in like an action situation possible, but they just do it 7 times in the first episode alone.
Yeah,
you're like, guys,
it carries on like that. And it is, I think it was a good idea on the author's part to have her be a nurse, though.
Yeah,
because it gives her an automatic role in the time that she's traveled back to. Obviously she has to like not talk about antiseptics and stuff, but
she does anyway
like she catches on and stops doing that, I think, but it means that she has a skill that she can kind of barter with in this society. So I
and
think
it gives her some authority, so that we're not in a situation where it's literally like, oh, a woman goes back in time and realizes she has to be subservient to everyone, which would have been boring. And I was kind of worried about that, because in the first few minutes she's almost raped and like kidnapped and assaulted in various ways, and you're like, oh, is this going to be the story of a woman going back in time and realizing that she like doesn't have any independence and has to just be at the whims of all these men, basically. And though it does touch on those frustrations in that she is trying to be as independent as she clearly was in her own life and is unable to be, but the fact that she knows a lot more than anyone else around her seems to do about how to make people better, she has this level of authority that means that people listen to her, especially in an urgent situation where she's like, give me this, give me that, and she swears a lot and people are like, oh my god, listen to this woman, she's telling me what to do and ordering me around and swearing at me, but they do it anyway because they're like, she seems to know what she's doing.
And there's also a nice bit, I think it's a few more episodes on, maybe episodes 4 or 5, where the laird's brother goes on a kind of journey to visit all of the sort of tenants and collect their rents for the year. Mm. And he takes with him his accountant, like factotum type man, who is a very educated lawyer from Edinburgh. And Claire and this guy like strike up a friendship, and they like to ride together and talk about politics. And this sort of helps her, because in a sense, this guy, Ned, he is employed by the clan for his education and his sort of perspicacity. The fact that he considers her to be an equal raises
right.
her, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So there's quite... They explore that dynamic quite interestingly, I think. There's also, as you mentioned, there is a kind of Game of Thrones-esque rape and murder aspect.
Yeah, I don't know if... I've not encountered that much of it so far. So far, I've seen more sort of like nudity and general violence, which I'm quite chill with generally.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fair amount of kind of, I don't want to say implicit rape, because I don't think I've actually seen anyone being raped, and I don't think you do see anyone be raped really, but the threat of violence, particularly against women,
kind of hangs in the air.
But again, I'm kind of okay with that, because I feel like it's realistic, sadly. If a soldier came across a, and we find out later that the soldier who finds her is a bad person, if a bad soldier finds a woman like in her underthings alone in the woods, chances are he is going to do something terrible to her.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's just the truth.
No, I agree. And I think also I haven't seen a situation where, I think what people object to with Game of Thrones is not that it happens or that it's there, but that it's used as a way to just kind of like add a bit of, you know, zhuzh to a bit of the show, and like basically used to titillate or give characters a more exciting plot. And I don't think that seems to be what they're doing here. Also, you know, it does make a difference, I think, that it's a female-led show.
Yes, she narrates it, a lot of it. It's all from her point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should talk a bit about Jamie, her Highland hunk.
Yeah, he is very hunky, isn't he? He's a very convenient hunk. He's like, it sometimes feels a bit like a willful fantasy that she's just like, oh, I just landed in this wood and like, here you are. Yeah. And like, here I am on your horse, because there's no other horse to take me. I'm just thrown into this situation. And you're like, oh, babe, you love it.
He is, I think, the strongest like romance-y element. Yeah. And I say romance in the kind of romance novel bodice ripper sense. He is the like strongest trope from that. And kind of unashamedly. And that's, again, that's something that first couple of episodes I was a bit like, meh. And I'm actually now quite into the series, and I'm definitely going to watch it through, and I've started like tracking the tags on Tumblr and things,
yeah,
which is how you know when I like something.
Yeah,
because it is a kind of bodice ripper romance trope, but because this show is entirely from a kind of female perspective, I'm fine with that. Those novels are always written for women.
Exactly.
And here we've got a novel written by a woman with a female character seeing it through her lens. It's an overt nod to the fact that women like pleasure. I don't know.
I think basically what shocked me, or not shocked me, but the reason maybe I've responded a little negatively towards it, is because it is so ashamed, and then they don't try to disguise it at all. They just go straight into it as soon as she arrives there, apart from like two men. He's the first person she sees, and it is very romance novel-esque in the way that she's sort of like trying to help him and stuff. But I think one of the things the show does really well is it does kind of foreground her pleasure. So in the what I felt was slightly too long build-up, where they sort of paint a picture of her life in the 40s, she is very in command of her own sex life. There's sort of like scenes where she's shown saying basically, oh, you know, me and my husband, we've had difficulties since the war ended, we spent 5 years apart, but we like still really enjoy having sex with each other. And you get like shots of that. And also they like go into this like underground cave thing that was like an old 18th century ruin. Yeah, and she like basically gets him to go down on her. He like tries to go in for the kiss and she's like, no, get down there, in a really great way. So they have made a real effort to say she's in command of her, you know, her own pleasure. She's also not a damsel in distress. Like that's quite inverted in a sense. Jamie is the one who's often relying on her for help. That for me remedies that.
Yeah, I like that about it as well. I also like two things. One, I really like the setting and the scenery, because as you can tell, I've just spent 2 weeks up there.
It is beautiful.
So it is really beautiful, and it's done. I was watching a little thing on YouTube about this. It's all filmed on location in Scotland as far as they possibly can. Where they've had to build sets, they've like recreated actual places in Scotland, right down to the point where one of the set designer people was saying how she'd like. The castle that they use for the exterior of the sort of clan seat, Well, while they were there, she took like casts, plaster casts of the outside of it. And then when she was building the sets for the inside so that the like stones would be the right size and the right texture and stuff.
That's
so they've really made a massive effort to like represent Scotland as it is or was, rather than like a kind of American fantasy version of it.
I also do really like, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but shows that are British made for an American audience.
Yeah. Another really good bit in this interview with the designer where she was saying that we're not like, she's American, almost all the crew seem to be American, but she said we didn't want to make it like tartan and haggis. People do wear tartan, but they wear the kind of muted tartans that people actually wore at the time that were practical to wear when you mostly lived outside in a forest, etc. etc. So that's really good that they haven't sort of like touristed it up. They've tried to farm out all the costume making and stuff to people at like Glasgow School of Art and things, so it's really been a good thing economy wise up there. The other thing I really liked about it is the period of history that it's set in.
I don't know much about this period at all.
This is exactly the point. No one does.
Yeah.
Because, at least not in England. We both went to school in England. And it doesn't really get talked about at all. I'd be interested to hear from any listeners. I know we do have some listeners up in Scotland. How much you get to learn about this. But we just don't learn about it at all.
No.
And I feel like this is a real failing. I mean, God, how many times do we have to learn about Henry VII and the beginnings of the Tudor dynasty?
Yeah.
When, you know, actual British soldiers were, like, killing their own people up there. So I was really excited and pleased to have a reason to learn more about
this
whole period.
Yeah, it made me really want to be, like, you know, there's that bit where she's like, oh, it was one of the Hanover monarchs, which one? And she's, like, thinking about, I was like, God, I just literally, what would I do in that situation? I'd be like, so...
Yeah, so
do you have a king? What?
I wrote a really long essay for the New Statesman last year when it was the 300th anniversary of the Hanoverian accession to the throne about this. So I learned loads about that and a little bit as it pertained to the rest of the UK, but not so much about Scotland. It was mostly focused on the kind of German English interchange. So I'm not going to lecture anyone about history now. If you're interested, you know, Wikipedia is always a good place to start. But I read a book while I was on holiday about the Highland clearances by a guy called Andy Whiteman. Very good book, called The Poor Had No Lawyers, about how the kind of traditional way of life in the Highlands and Islands got completely destroyed by the British immediately after the period that Outlander focuses on.
Right.
So after the Battle of Culloden, which I think is in 1746, which is basically when all the Scottish people got massacred, the British went on this kind of systematic campaign of clamping down on the way of life that Outlander portrays. So like tartans and clans were banned, Gaelic as a language was suppressed, and people were moved off the land that they'd always worked on. They were cleared out, hence clearances, to live and work somewhere else in an attempt to kind of break up their way of life. So I think it's really interesting to see a kind of pop culture take on a period of history that doesn't really get pop culture takes.
It's like, okay, we've done the Tudors pretty much to death at this point in popular culture.
There's a lot of Rome, there's a lot of, I feel like, a fair amount of Victoriana.
Mm.
So it's nice to get a different period of history and from a place that doesn't often get non-stereotypical representations.
Yeah. I do have one question. Surely there would be some dialect change. Why can they all just, like, chat? Like, she can just chat to everyone in her normal, like... Surely the kind of English they would have been speaking would have been, like, dramatically different.
Yeah,
to the English
I think it would have. I think there would have been
They sometimes chat in like stock phrases and you're like, really? And then occasionally she's like Ken instead of no and you're like no.
Yeah, no, I think they would have had more especially the less educated people would have had great difficulty.
And they do obviously sometimes speak in Gaelic around her and she's like, I don't know what anyone's saying, but you're just like, would you really know when they were speaking English either? Really?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I found that sometimes in the islands is like I couldn't tell whether people were speaking Gaelic or just heavily accented dialect.
Well, if
English.
You couldn't understand that today, I don't know what chance Claire Beecham's got in 1743. So I don't really know how they can get over that hurdle, but I'm pointing it out.
Yeah, you know, I even went as so far as to try and, because our colleague Stephanie speaks Gaelic and lent me some books about it when she knew I was going up there, so I was reading them while I was away. And I was watching an episode of Outlander one time and I was like, I'm going to see if I can turn the subtitles on and see if I've actually learned anything from this book.
And do they do it?
There are no subtitles.
That's really cool, because I wasn't sure as well whether, sometimes I'm like, are you really speaking Gaelic or are you just like saying noises?
I was really annoyed.
That's a shame.
But no, it is real Gaelic though, because I saw an interview with Sam Hugan, I think his name is, the guy who plays Jamie, where, because he is Scottish, and he was saying that he's from one of the big cities, though this is not like his background, really. But he's
not his background in 1743.
But I mean, like, he's not like from Inverness or something, where this is more of a thing. He actually really enjoyed learning all about this and had started taking Gaelic lessons, and in order to be able to do it properly on the show, and they had a few clips of him being coached and stuff, and he spoke very eloquently about how he felt like it was really nice to have an opportunity to kind of get involved with his country's heritage and
well, that's so nice
and stuff. So I think it is real Gaelic, basically.
Good on you, Sam. Song of a lass that is gone, say could that lass be I? Mary of soul, she sailed on a day over the sea to sky. Mole was a stem, rum on the port, ek on the starboard bow. So the next thing we're going to talk about is Welcome to Night Vale, the podcast taking the world by storm. I don't really know how to describe it brilliantly, but it's sort of like a fake community radio show set in the fictional arid little hamlet of Night Vale. And there's a lot of weird goings on in Night Vale. Basically, it's done very well in the format of a sort of traditional community radio show with like updates about the town, news bulletins, the weather. But each time, something more and more bizarre and deeply horrifying seems to be occurring in Night Vale. I've listened to the first sort of 13 episodes, I think, and it's brilliant. It like took me a little while to kind of get into the rhythm of it. When I was first listening, I was like, this makes me feel uncomfortable, even though nothing scary is really happening. I don't like this feeling. But now, yeah, I'm sort of really into the flow of it and really enjoying it. What do you think, Caroline?
Yeah, I agree. So I think Night Vale, the town, is supposed to be in Arizona or somewhere like that, somewhere with massive empty horizons. And
there's no water at all in the town.
Yeah, it's very deserty. But they've done a really good job of building up this place in your mind, using only audio.
And the ones I've listened to, it's just literally one guy to the mic. They don't sort of like go and give you sound clips from the town. It's just this guy like reading the bulletins.
And then some sound effects sometimes, and music. Yeah, they've built up this picture of this town. There are kind of regularly occurring characters that get mentioned. There's a football team and a school and all of these things, and they all get touched on. Old Woman Josie. And what's the name of the scientist that he fancies?
Carlos.
Carlos, yes, who's a kind of local scientist. And the radio host really likes him and often talks about how his hair is lovely and stuff. And it's just really sweet. But it is deeply unsettling. I think I particularly recommended episode 13 to you.
Yeah, this is a radio show about you, it was called, or something.
Favourite one, and it's also the one I found the creepiest, because it's all in the second person. It breaks out of its normal sort of like parish notices format and becomes like one single monologue, like a story about you, the person, the subject of the thing, and you're doing, and it's all addressed to you, and it's really terrifying and it's really meta.
This is a story about you. You live in a trailer out near the car lot next to Old Woman Josie's house. Occasionally, she'll wave at you on her way out to get the mail or more snacks for the angels. Occasionally, you'll wave back. You're not a terrible neighbor as far as it goes. At night, you can see the red light blinking on and off on top of the radio tower, a tiny flurry of human activity against the implacable backdrop of stars and void.
That was the one for me where I properly fell in love with it.
Yeah.
Because it's such clever writing. If you want to give this a go, I would recommend maybe a random one from like 1 to 10 and then listen to that one as well. And that gives you kind of both styles that they do.
Some of it as well kind of verges on satire. Like, to call it satire, I think, is like a bad way of describing what it is, because it's not at all topical. It's very sort of comes at things from very weird angles, and that's where the humour in it lies. But like, sometimes there are moments where you do laugh because you're like, this is verging on what real life is like. So for example, there's a bulletin where he reads out changes to the school curriculum, and he says things like, English and math have swapped names, the syllabus remains exactly the same. And then at one point he's like, Pluto has been declared imaginary. And it really brings home like the idiocy of the fact that we've been like calling Pluto a planet and then something else, and we have to have all these labels for stuff without actually changing our notion of what Pluto is in any real sense. So things like that, I think, are really strokes of genius.
Yeah, and there's a kind of supernatural element to it as well, but it's addressed in such a matter-of-fact way that I find really sort of endearing. Like, there's one whole episode where there are just random hooded figures everywhere in Night Vale, and then one of them gets in the studio, and he just keeps saying, like, hooded figure is looking at me through the door. I carry on broadcasting.
Yeah. And then there's like this hissing, like the static noise that I'm sure our listeners are familiar with from our own podcast, where he just starts going, and then he's like, do not adjust your radio. This is not a fault. That is the exact sound coming from the hooded man's face. Like, and there's another episode where like a cloud sort of seems to take over the room, and he's like, the cloud is nothing. It is not your god. It is not your friend. It only exists. You are a slave to the cloud. So yeah, it's really funny, but it's just like so bizarre that it really takes... You have to kind of give it a chance before you can...
The other not really nice thing they do is... So the weather that they do every time. The weather is not the weather. The weather is a random song. And they they just go, and now, the weather. And then it plays a song for 3.5 minutes.
It's always
minutes.
Got really, like, weird and depressing lyrics.
Yeah.
But I love that as well. Because there's one of the tropes in it that I've noticed already is they say... They have, like, fake adverts and things like that where they're like, if you'd like to call in, just whisper, I'm alone, into the abyss. I love all those kinds of things. It reminded me weirdly of that completely different style of thing. When I was a kid, there was this program on like Cartoon Network called Sheep in the Big City. Mm. And when I talk about it to people, they're always like, I think you've made this up. This isn't a real program. But it was about a farmer trying to track down his sheep in the city. But every episode, they would have like a fake advert break. And it would be for things called like Shrimpola Cola, now made with real shrimp. And then like someone would drink it and go, it burns. And it's like really juvenile humor, but it just like absolutely got me really giggling. And so yeah, some of the fake adverts I really really enjoy, which are like, come to the abandoned parking lot behind the Ralphs, huddle with us. You may be thinking, who are we? Come to the abandoned parking lot behind Ralphs and huddle with us. It just keeps saying the same thing over and over.
They do a really good job of playing with the sort of traditional local radio formats, basically, don't they?
Yeah.
Which is really fun. And as you say, it works particularly well with the adverts. But yeah, also stuff like announcing school soccer team fixtures and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like one of the other quotes I really loved from it was when he was like, the school soccer captain thanked the angels for their part in his success. The school is doing an investigation into any angelic activity surrounding the match. Yeah, I kind of feel like with this kind of show, you don't want to dissect it too much because I don't want to... It just is so funny. So I kind of feel like the only thing we can say is, like, go and listen to it.
The other thing related to that is that there is a really sort of strong, vibrant community has built up around it on Tumblr, where people draw fan art based on episodes and based on
That's
characters
so nice.
And stuff, and some of it is so beautiful. So I thought we could this week we'll reblog a load of that on Tumblr. So if you'd like to we're seriouslypod.tumblr.com, and you can see some of it there. There's some particularly nice pictures of Carlos, I seem to remember.
That's great, because although it is an audio-based format, obviously, it is weirdly, like, visually lush. Mm. Like, I get a real sense of the colours and, like, the atmosphere there.
It's kind of purpley, dusky, isn't it?
Dark blue. Yeah. Maybe, like, a streak of pink in there sometimes. The mood and atmosphere is so strong that you can't help but paint pictures in your mind. So I feel like fan art is just going to be a natural extension of this kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really beautiful. I want to give another shout out to
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Another podcast that's just started that's kind of doing a little bit like what Welcome to Night Vale does, but it's called Limetown. If you imagine a mashup between Welcome to Night Vale and Serial, the kind of true crime journalistic investigation podcast, then you get Limetown. It's a fictional podcast, but it's done in the style of an American public radio journalist investigating a mysterious disappearance at a place that sounds a lot like Night Vale. And they're kind of, it's kind of a bit difficult to follow in, because they're unlike Serial, where they did the whole investigation for a year and then produced all the episodes. The way they're doing Limetown is they're, and I guess maybe this works better because it's fictional, they're kind of releasing stuff as and when new developments in the case occur. So it's a bit random. So I listened to the first two episodes and I was like, yeah, this is really good. I want to get into this. When's the next one? And there's only just been a next, like, you know, it's really sporadic and spaced out.
So is it by the same people or is it a completely separate thing?
Completely separate, I think.
Right.
It's by different people. But I'm kind of intrigued to see where it goes, because I'm interested in this idea that, because I feel like podcasts, it's such a young medium, it's so new. And for the 10 years or so that podcasts have existed, it's mostly been roughly what Anna and I are doing now, which is some people sitting in a basement talking into microphones and to each other.
Yeah.
Mostly about current affairs, or this comedy's always been massive, or what we're doing now, kind of pop culture. And there've been a few kind of innovators on the fictional front, of which Welcome to Night Vale is kind of chief among them. But that's a really underexplored area of the medium, I think.
I was really reading an app maker talking about how people think when you open an app, you need to understand it straight away. So that means that the format of the app is like quite underused in storytelling, because confusion and like figuring stuff out is obviously an important part of like the arts, basically. And I think the same could be said for podcasting, in that you kind of already know what you're going to get before you listen to most podcasts. So like our podcast, or like Lena Dunham's new podcast, like you kind of know what it's going to be before you start.
I like that. Whereas, those are in the same sentence, by the way.
Only from my mouth. And so this idea that you can like start listening to something that doesn't quite make sense and confuses you but then grips you, actually, is a really nice thing.
The app parallel is a good one. It reminds me, there's a really good phone app game called Monument Valley, which reminds me a lot of Welcome to Night Vale, now I come to think about it, which is exactly what you describe. It kind of, it's really beautiful, it has lovely music that goes with it, and you're a kind of little person. It's in premise, the game is very similar to something like Super Mario, where like you're a little person and you have to guide them through obstacles to get to the end. But it's all of the action in the game is to do with rotating elements of the world in ways that they don't immediately look like they can. So it's a bit like, you know, like the Escher staircase.
Yeah.
It's all like that, trying to rotate things to find the planes on which your person can walk.
Yeah, that's fun.
And you can stare at it for, like, minutes, hours even, and be like, there is no way this person can get there. And then you stab at the screen a bit, you're like, oh, yeah, that bit moves. So it's not immediately apparent when you first open it that there's anything you can do with it. But it's still beautiful and interesting.
Exactly, and I think that's the joy of a lot of these things. So congrats to the makers of Welcome to Night Vale, and hopefully they'll inspire lots of, as they already are doing, inspire lots of other podcasters to get creative with the format.
Yeah.
And now the swappy reviewy part of the show.
I was thinking, we should think of a name for this. Why didn't we think of a name for this before we started this? Because then we could be really cool and be like, and now the beginning of the blah, blah, blah segment.
I've always wanted to have a thing called the Analyst.
Which is
a list of me analysing things. But it doesn't really work. The Caroline and analyst. I don't know. It's a thing anyway. So
That bit. We're going to do that bit now.
We're going to do it. We're doing it. So Caroline, last week or a little while ago now, we agreed that you were going to read I Love Dick, the Chris Krause sort of epistemological...
Epistolary,
that's the word. Feminist, I mean, novel? Do we call it a novel? What do we call it? I don't know.
I think probably it's an epistolary novel in the sense that it's mostly told through letters and transcripts of phone conversations and faxes and stuff. But I don't want to get into what is a novel. The book looks like it's a novel, so let's say it's a novel.
It definitely comes as a book.
It comes as a book. So I read this while I was on holiday, and I ended up really, really loving it.
Good.
I did not like it for the first third.
I had a very similar experience with this book, I'd say. In fact, I think it took me probably longer than you to decide that I liked it. Because so many people I knew were raving about it, and it was so, I found it so, like, theoretical.
Mm.
I found it very, like, heavy going. And then there was a point, I can't remember what the line was or what the phrase was, but there was a point where I was like, oh my God, this all makes so much sense suddenly. And I one of the things I like about it a lot is that it's almost like there's heat coming off of it. It's so full of like raw emotion at all times. And that's something that you don't often read like that. I think even if you are reading, you know, very emotional novels, I don't think it has that level of sort of like almost rage.
Yeah, and desire, and sort of raging desire. That's why the kind of epistolary form works so brilliantly, I think, because you're not getting her emotions mediated at one remove through paraphrase or indirect speech or anything like that. You are getting the letters as she writes them, in the order she writes them, the phone conversations in the order they happen. So it's the closest you can get, I think, in the kind of printed word, written word form, to feeling close to what's happening in someone's mind at a given moment.
Yeah.
We should say briefly what it's about. It's called I Love Dick. When you are reading that title in a kind of acid green copy on a ferry to the Isle of Skye, say, and people see you reading this, they might start huddled conversations in Gaelic in corners about you. That might be a thing that will happen.
Yeah, it's a real experiment, isn't it?
Because they will make certain assumptions about what the book is about. That is wrong. The book is called I Love Dick because...
She's obviously playing with the
She's playing with that assumption. But the book is about a character called Chris Krause, who happens to have the same name as the author, and her husband, Silver, who happens to have the same name as the author's ex-husband.
Mm-hmm.
Their sort of obsession and infatuation with a man called Dick.
I can't remember where they meet him now. They're at a party and he's there, or in a bar or something.
They go for a dinner at his house, I think. Or they meet him at a bar and then they go back to his house for dinner. I can't remember. But they end up staying over the first night at his house. And then when they wake up, he's not there. He's gone out, and they sort of leave before he comes back. So he's this kind of eternally not present object of desire.
Which I think is always how it has to be when you desire someone like that. You can't know them. You can't really have a real understanding of them as a human.
But so Chris and Silver get really into the idea that she fancies Dick.
They sort of talk about it. They've got a long drive home from his house or wherever they've seen him, haven't they? And they spend the entire journey kind of like talking about Dick and like what Dick's life might be like and why they both felt so compelled by him.
And then when they get home, they start writing letters to Dick that they never intend to publish or post or anything. They're just sort of... they exist only in the moment for them to write down and for each other to sort of read and laugh at and enjoy. And then they kind of, they separate for a while because he has to go and do some teaching in Paris or something, and they're moving from where they've been in California to New York, and so she's driving across the country. This is where, because I had a similar moment to you where it suddenly was like, oh, this book isn't rubbish, this book is brilliant. And for me, it happened while she was on this drive from California to New York, and she was kind of staying in all of these motels and kind of stopping randomly on the road. And the whole time she's kind of talking to Dick in her head, she's writing letters to him in the evening. And I think the bit that made me pivot and like it was when she's staying in a motel one night and she's writing a letter to Dick, and in the letter she's like, I'm only writing this because I left my book in the car and I can't be bothered to get cold again just to read a few more lines of Guillaume Apollinaire. And suddenly that's like, yes, I love you. That is exactly how... Because there's so much contained in that, because she's like, I'm reading this book because I think I ought to. I'm not necessarily enjoying it. Mm. And now I've had to quantify it against, do I want to read it enough to get slightly cold? And I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Part of that as well, that idea, it's like, oh, Dick, I'm only writing to you because of this, or, you know, X, Y, and Z. There's something quite like, although it can sound like a fairly anti-feminist thing to be like, oh yeah, this woman just gets completely obsessed with this man and like writes to him all the time about how much she loves him. It's not like that at all. She's very much the person with the power in the novel. And she's sort of harnessing her own like desire as a way to empower herself, which is like not a way I'd ever seen, especially female feelings of like longing framed. It had always been like, oh yeah, this kind of like sad, needy girl. And although she kind of is that, it's just framed in this incredibly like active, powerful, dominant way. It made me really excited, that idea.
I would link it very much to Magic Mike in this sense.
Yeah.
Not that everything's about Magic Mike, but a lot of things are about, as you will have learned from this podcast, a lot of things are about Magic Mike. In the same way that when we talked about Magic Mike very early on in the podcast, I think episode 2, if you want to go back and listen to that, one of the reasons that we and lots of other people really like Magic Mike is because it makes explicit on screen the fact that women are allowed to like look at and enjoy men's bodies. And this is related, this novel, because whilst, yeah, she is being kind of needy and she kind of self-admits at times a bit pathetic about it, she is writing about it and acting on it and living it. And we are getting that expressed in a way that almost never happens. You know, in so many novels, it's just like, oh yeah, and then Jane Eyre was a bit sad.
Yeah.
Moving on.
And she's also actively theorising it and creating a way of living out of an emotion, which is really like rare to do.
She's not justifying. She's not saying, oh yeah, I'm being really sort of like weird about Dick, but you know, it's okay though, because my film's not doing very well, so I'm really sad.
Yeah.
She's just, it's just accepted. It's like, yeah, I'm experiencing a period of desire for this man. Here are my thoughts about it.
And I like it, again, it's sort of in Magic Mike, they do a thing where they're like, hey, this is our like mission statement, as it were. This is how we look at female desire, and it's an important part of our life, and this is our relationship to it. And that's what she's doing in I Love Dick. And I think the fact that you say, you know, oh, I can be sat on the bus reading this book called I Love Dick and people like murmur and titter, I kind of feel like that's part of what she's doing in this, because it is quite shocking to say like, yeah, I experience desire for male bodies. That's something that happens to me. And I think that's quite unusual, especially for, you know, this is a fairly like teenage book in a way.
Mm.
She's what, in her 40s or late
30s?
So I think that's, it's quite unusual to allow women of that age to have extreme feelings like that. Or if they do, it's considered, you know, ridiculous and hysterical. Whereas this is a way of making those feelings both extremely fervent and extremely, not quite uncontrollable, but, you know, difficult to manage, and yet also extremely intelligent and worthwhile and might actually give you something and lend you something.
As I say, I didn't enjoy the book all the way through, but I definitely was really enjoying it by the end.
Mm.
So I would encourage listeners to read it. I mean, it has now finally been published in the UK. It was first published in the US in the 90s, in the aforementioned acid green edition. That
it's really nice.
It's a really nice book, really nice object. I'd really encourage people to read it and to kind of push through it, to not be put off after the first 30 pages.
Yeah, because I also found it very difficult to get to grips with her tone and her voice and stuff. But then having read it, it's now something that like literally enters my thoughts all the time.
Mm.
Like every piece I write, I'll be like, as Chris Krauss says. And I just like I can't imagine what it was like to have a brain that hadn't read I Love Dick, you know. Although I wouldn't say it was like the book that gripped me most or the book that I like enjoyed reading the most. I now look back and I'm like, wow, imagine if you hadn't read that book. And like, yeah, I feel like it's formed a lot of my thoughts about the world. So yeah, I would definitely recommend it.
So from that to something a bit different, for next week, Anna, I'm going to recommend you the 2005 film Transamerica, which is a kind of, I suppose, a comedy drama. It's not a romantic.
You seem unsure about that label.
I am unsure about that label because I feel like I'm saying it's two things at once, but it can be two things at once. It's a film, it's a story about a trans woman going on a road trip with her son, who she didn't know that she had a son because she'd only ever had sex once, sort of pre-transition, and she had no idea that it resulted in conception, and suddenly she's confronted right at the moment when, because it's, I think she's just about to have her surgery, and she's right at the point of this kind of big momentous change in her life that she's been kind of desperate for and longing for and working towards for years, and suddenly this kind of new thing is thrown at her, like, oh my goodness, I have a child. I think he's in his late teens, he's like 17 or 18 or something. He's in trouble and there's no one else they can call, so she ends up having to go and pick him up, and they drive all the way across America together to get back to where she lives in California. She picks him up in New York, I think. In the process of this, you know, what, 4 or 5 day journey, they kind of get to know each other a bit, and they talk about her gender identity and how she's arrived where she is. A friend of mine really, you know, when someone's really passionate about something and they yeah. like push the DVD on you, a friend of mine did that about 4 or 5 years ago. He gave me the DVD and then asked me every time I saw him after that.
Have you seen it
have
yet?
Have you watched it yet? Well, once I watched it, I did understand why, because it's not the kind of portrayal of these issues, in inverted commas, that you often get to see. It goes back to what we were talking about when we talked about the sitcom Boy Meets Girl, that I feel like when you do get sort of trans stories told in popular culture, they're often about sort of violence and abuse and difficulty, and there is difficulty in this story, but it is fundamentally someone who has managed their transition quite well and is quite okay.
Yeah.
And it's been quite lucky. And the drama of the story therefore rests in her, like, this thing with her family and this thing with her son that could happen to anybody. It's not happening because she's trans, you know.
It's not an inherently trans plotline.
Not at all. And so I understood why he was so passionate about this film after I'd watched it, because it's so rare, and all the better for it.
Cool. Well, I'm really excited to watch it. That'll be fun. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoy what we do, you might want to consider following us on Twitter at @SRSLYpod. We post links to things we've mentioned in the show, gifts we like, and all manner of other things you'll probably enjoy.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.